This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bob Oakes, and this is On Point. Milton Hershey dreamed big. The Pennsylvania farm kid with more moxie than money created a chocolate empire that still reigns supreme, and his cravings went beyond the chocolate bar. Hershey's business success was matched by his devotion to social improvement. He built a company town to house his workers, started up a school for boys, spoke out on social issues. He also gambled big time and more than once almost lost it all. A delicious new biography tells the story of his rocky rise to the top of the chocolate mountain. This hour on Point, a true life story and vision of the man behind the chocolate bar. Joining us now from Washington is Michael D'Antonio, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book titled Hershey, Milton S. Hershey's Extraordinary Life of Wealth, Empire, and Utopian Dreams. Michael, thanks very much for joining us on Point.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Let's talk about Milton Hershey's childhood, in large part because it shaped his life. Tell us what it was like for him in the early years. He was not exactly born with a chocolate spoon in his mouth.
No, he wasn't. I would say the richest things he acquired in childhood were the examples of his mother and father. His father kind of dragged him around the countryside in the 1860s seeking wealth and fame on his own. But he was a very dreamy character, so he was one of those rare people who went to the oil fields in around Titusville, Pennsylvania, and didn't get rich. He went broke, and his mother's brothers came with wagons and hauled them all back to the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area. Back there, he couldn't just have a farm. He had to have an experimental farm, and all of his crops had to be unusual and so unusual that no one wanted to buy them. So again, he went bust. And Milton was a kid who probably didn't have shoes until he was 11 or 12 years old. His education didn't go beyond the sixth grade, and he literally was hungry often. His mother would struggle to feed Milton and his sister. His sister passed away before she was 6 years old. So it was a very hard kind of wandering life for many years.
I'm wondering if you think that his father, Henry, who was a man, as you write in the book, of playful schemes and big ideas, I'm wondering if his father's imagination and his desire to get rich inspire Milton later in life.
I have no doubt about it. You know, he was a remarkable character, and I would have loved to have spent time with him. He was self-educated and really a polymath. He had this scheme for a perpetual motion machine. He wanted to create telecommunications along the wire fences that farmers strung. He just had big ideas and was very well read, but no ability to make any of them come true. And his mother was quite the opposite. She was a very serious, devout Mennonite woman who believed in the value of hard work, but also the value of community and a person's sense of obligation to the greater good. So he had these polar opposite influences, and I think that they're both really evident in the life and legacy that he went on to achieve.
Talk about the marriage between Henry, the father, and Fanny, the mother. If opposites attract, well, these were two opposites. It was not a marriage made in heaven.
No, although I think it might have been a marriage made in Henry's magnetic personality. It was clear that women liked Henry Hershey, and I think that marrying him may have been the one rebellious thing that Fanny did, although she should have seen a sign in the fact that he showed up late for the wedding and far better dressed than the bride. He made a big impression on everyone. And I think she quickly fell out of love with him. But divorce wasn't a possibility for religious reasons. And so the two eventually led separate lives, with Henry wandering not only Pennsylvania but the country, trying to make it as a silver miner in Colorado and failing. And then he was going to be an artist in New York City. And it got to the point where Fanny told people he was dead although he lived another 30 or 40 years.
Why did they fall out of love? Was Henry not practical enough for Fanny?
Well, he sure wasn't. And although Milton led an impoverished childhood, Fanny actually came from a family with some money, and she had gone to finishing school. And I think her expectations were much higher. And she valued thrift and valued hard work. And, you know, this we sometimes do well when we decide to rebel and marry the person who's the opposite of what we've been accustomed to, and sometimes it backfires, and I think it backfired in this case for Fanny.
Let's talk about their son, the chocolate man, Milton Hershey. In the book, you describe Milton as a man infected with his mother's high expectations and his father's dreamy ambitions. We've talked about the father's ambitions. How did his mother's high expectations affect Milton?
Well, you know, this is interesting. We all, I think, have seen mothers who invest all their hopes in perhaps a son or their only child. And since his sister Serena died early, Fanny was left with this one child that she focused all of her energy and all of her love upon. And he felt that. But what's fascinating is she gave him a sense of confidence that I think would be wonderful for all of us to have as we leave the nest and go into the world. He imagined himself in big ways. He had Henry's imagination and yet this sense of certainty that he could work hard and make it happen. And, you know, even failing grandly three times in a row didn't seem to stop this guy. He went off to Philadelphia during the Great Centennial Exposition of 1876, made it big for a while millions of people were coming to the fair, but then lost it all when the fair ended. He then went on to New York, where he tried hard and failed again, and then Chicago, where he tried hard and failed again. But each time, his mother and his mother's sister, his Aunt Mattie, backed him not only with whatever cash they could scrape up, but they would come to his stores and his little factories or, you know, kitchens and work themselves long hours making and wrapping candies to help make this boy a success.
Now, you might think up to this point in the conversation that Milton Hershey was a very well-educated young man. But in fact, he left school at the age of 12.
This was another point of contention between mother and father. Henry, who never had formal schooling, would have given anything to be a man of letters. He wanted to be a writer. He could debate any preacher on matters of scripture and be ruled the winner by whoever was standing around. And he wanted his son to be the scholar and writer that he never was. Fanny saw nothing but danger in all of this and thought that books had been the ruin of Henry and wasn't going to have it. So she made sure he was apprenticed ultimately to the candy maker in the town of Lancaster.
You're talking about Royer's Ice Cream Parlor and Garden?
Right, right. And you know, one wonderful thing about being given an opportunity to write a biography or a history is you get to learn so much. And Lancaster turned out to be a really hopping place in the 1860s and 70s.
You portray it as this as a center of American culture at the time.
It really was. It was the home of the first great American aerialist. He was this Wizard of Oz, you know, character who launched his balloons from the town square, and people would come, and it would be a great event. The first commercial telegraph ran from Lancaster to Harrisburg, and the first real paved road connected the farms of Lancaster County to Philadelphia so people could buy produce from this rich farmland. And so it was a really fertile place. There was a great theater called the Fulton Theater where lecturers like Mark Twain would come, and he would regale a packed house, and people would come out of the theater laughing and then head straight to Royer's for candy and cake. And Milton was in the middle of all this, and I think it was very stimulating for him.
We're going to talk about Milton Hershey, the chocolate maker, in a minute, but first let's stay on the background just for another moment. What was in the air at that time, especially in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, about American business, about workers, about the social fabric of America?
Well, it's an interesting thing because there were plenty of ambitious capitalists there, and many products that people would not associate with a place like Lancaster were made. It was the home of the Conestoga wagon, for example, that took everyone west, and a lot of manufacturing of things like watches and machinery and railroad cars and all kinds of things. But it also had the influence of Amish and Mennonite culture. So there was a respect for the worker and a respect for craftsmanship that would be a little different than something you might have seen in the big mills of the steel industry, where conditions were very harsh and there was almost from the beginning a conflict of labor and capital. I think in Lancaster, people were aware of a balance. It's a very measured philosophy.
Michael, let's talk about chocolate. Milton Hershey was doing a pretty good business making caramel candies, first in Colorado and Denver, and then in Lancaster. In Lancaster, he had a factory with hundreds of employees, but was convinced that that business would not long last.
You're absolutely right, and I didn't know that there was a caramel craze in America in the 1880s when people started to make it with milk that was subtly pasteurized. I'm not sure they even knew that they were pasteurizing it. But prior to this point, prior to the so-called Denver caramel recipe coming along, it was made of paraffin. So that was the one thing they had to make chewy candies, and it wasn't all that pleasant. But once this breakthrough was made, caramel factories sprung up in every American city. It was a huge business. It made Milton wealthy, and he used the money to travel. When he went abroad, he quickly discovered that the Swiss had finally perfected milk chocolate, and he saw that other companies, especially Cadbury's in Great Britain, were starting to capitalize on this new product in a big way. And, you know, neuroscience has taught us that chocolate acts on the same part of the brain that responds to cocaine. It goes right to a certain pleasure center. Back then, of course, no one knew that for certain, but they could see it. You know, you could see that the person who had their first taste of milk chocolate wanted more, and they typically would have it often. So he came back to the United States and told his associates, "I'm getting out of the caramel business. Chocolate is the new thing." They literally said he should have his head examined, but he proceeded, made a wonderful deal for his company, and then went straight into developing a recipe of his own and eventually manufacturing chocolate.
You write that in 1893, at the World's Columbian Exposition, in Chicago, he got inspiration when he saw German chocolate-making machines.
Right. Now, all of us who've read the marvelous book, The Devil in the White City, understand that the Columbian Exposition was a watershed. So many products that we take for granted today in foods and manufacturing devices were debuted at the exposition. And these were wonderful learning opportunities for the public, but also for business people and industrialists. And Milton was enough of a traveler by then that he knew he wanted to go there and spend a good long time looking things over. He discovered not only a chocolate house and other demonstrations of chocolate products, but this complete small chocolate factory in operation, pumping this wonderful aroma of chocolate into the fairgrounds, watched it for hours on end, and then when the fair closed, bought every scrap of equipment and had it shipped to Lancaster.
but while he had the equipment, he didn't know exactly what to do with it at the beginning. And you paint a terrific image of Hershey and his team of scientists, so to speak, holed up at the farmstead experimenting with chocolate.
Yes, you know, his mother's family and his father's family both had farms, and he went to the Hershey family farm and worked in the barn there to perfect this recipe. He had borrowed and stolen plenty of ideas during his trips to Europe, and all great artists and business people are willing to steal, I think, at least when it comes to concepts. And yet he didn't have it all. Combining watery milk with oily cocoa beans and cocoa butter is a tough thing to do, and it takes very precise conditions. So he conducted hundreds of experiments. But he, you know, maybe this is what happens when a mother tells a son that he can do anything. While he was experimenting, and before he even had the recipe, he was building what would eventually be the world's largest chocolate factory in an empty cornfield in the middle of nowhere. So as the final bricks are being laid on the tall smokestacks, he finally perfects this recipe and is able to convert the small batch methods to this industrial scale and start pumping out Hershey's chocolate.
Without getting too technical in terms of ingredients, how does a Hershey's bar differ from fine European chocolate? Just so we understand what Hershey did in the barn.
Well, and you know, this is hard for Americans actually to detect, but there is a what they call at Hershey a cow taste. And I don't know, I think this has to do with the fact that it was invented in a cow barn. But this slightly sour note that you might get as you're finishing a Hershey bar, where you detect a little bit of turned milk. And I think in this case, the recipe involved heating the milk beyond the level that it's heated in Swiss chocolate or Belgian chocolate or British chocolate, so that it's not quite as sweet in the same way. Now, we're all given a Hershey bar just about in America as our first taste of chocolate. So we come to associate the flavor of Hershey chocolate with chocolate, and it's a comfort food. And I know when I'm at a supermarket or in a store, I have to consciously decide each time I see the Hershey bars whether I'm going to buy one or not. But people who visit from abroad will take a bite of this chocolate bar and say, this is what passes for chocolate?
On the flip side, many Americans who've grown up with the Hershey's chocolate bar don't like the European chocolates.
Right. We find them too sweet and maybe even a little bland. But I find that connoisseurs will nevertheless sneak a Hershey bar from time to time. I did an event in Hershey on Tuesday, and I wish they hadn't done this. They gave me about 10 pounds of chocolate in a bag, and I think they were trying to impress me by adding some locally made specialty chocolates. But as I left, I pulled the Hershey bar out of the bag, and I ate that.
Tell us, if you would, the story of the creation, his own creation, of Chocolate Town, Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Well, this is a thing that marks Milton Hershey as almost unique among industrialists of his time. His goal was not to produce chocolate per se. Chocolate was a means to an end. His real goal was to create the ideal community in America. And utopian concepts were really in the air in the 1880s to perhaps 1910. Lots of people were talking about the perfectibility of community life, and this was the height of the progressive political movement. Pullman, for example, tried to create the perfect industrial town around his railroad car company outside of Chicago, but it was ultimately a fairly dreary place where people rented apartments, and even a membership at the library was not free. You had to pay a pretty substantial fee. Milton had this idea that he would create a perfect little village where the buildings were all different, people owned their homes, they didn't rent, and that the community provided amenities on a par with or superior to the great cities of the world. And he was so serious about this that he started building the town as he started building the factory, and went away while the first houses were put up. When he came back, he saw that the first three were identical, and he had them torn down. He said, I'm not building that kind of community. I'm building a real town. And so the town of Hershey was born as the ultimate expression of his dream. And the chocolate became the engine that powered the local economy. I often compare it to a little oil-rich state in the Persian Gulf. You know, this product was a kind of dark gold. It wasn't oil, but it was chocolate. And with the milk of the farmers in the region and the labor of the local people, it kept pouring out of this factory and money poured back in.
We want to get to the callers before they melt, and you don't have to boo me for the poor pun. I'll boo myself. But before we do, let me ask you this. Was there a Hershey cult? And if so, how was it viewed?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because there were commentators who came to Hershey later and would criticize the all things good kind of version of Hershey that was sent out across the land. And they were very careful to construct an image that was very positive with no hints of any problems. But I think that people in that day were more ready to believe that there was a great man with a great idea who could lead them somewhere. So even now, if you go to Hershey as an outsider, it's a little discomforting. You almost feel like you're in the Truman Show, you know, that someone's created this perfect place. It might be enclosed in a bubble, and you might almost be psychologically manipulated into thinking, you know, this is indeed the greatest place on earth. And it's not. And Milton certainly wasn't a perfect man. He had a lot of quirks, and there was a dark side to him, as there is to everyone. And it's one reason that it took so long for a book of like mine to come out is that I had to penetrate this myth. And for years, people were very resistant to talking about the parts that didn't look so great.
Michael D'Antonio, author of the new book on the chocolate man Milton Hershey. Stay with us as we take a couple of phone calls. Julie's dialing from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Wow, this is a fun topic. Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hershey bars say to me childhood and s'mores around the campfire, and it was always a very special thing when my mother would allow us to have Hershey bar with almonds. Yes, with almonds. Those were extra special. And I agree about the town of Hershey. Every time my husband and I are driving through Pennsylvania, no matter where we're going, we make an effort to stop through Hershey and spend the night. And it's like a magical kind of town. The idea that a town was built around and revolves around a chocolate factory is just the neatest thing, you know?
Julie, that magic you feel?
Yes.
That's the sugar buzz.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you travel there, you do notice that the place smells like chocolate. It really does. And I guess folks who live there get used to it the way that people who work around barns get used to the smell of manure, but I never quite got used to it.
Well, it's like the place where the factory from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory could actually exist, you know? I guess it's a lot of childhood memories that make it such a fun place, but I've been to the Hershey Hotel and the spa and had a cocoa bean scrub, which was one of the most incredible things I've ever had in my life. I recommend that highly to everyone, and the smell of chocolate is just intoxicating, so there's lots of neat things to do there revolving around chocolate, but you're right about it not being a perfect town. I love going there. I feel I'm on a euphoric high. Maybe it is the chocolate buzz, but I don't think I could ever live there.
Julie, thank you very much for your thoughts and your memories. Let's take another call. Ray is also dialing from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I was wondering if your Mr. D'Antonio could verifies a research thing that I've been this plagued us for years. Friends of mine, we were all English majors in college, and when Tennessee Williams died, he died some bizarre way of choking on something, and someone at that group said that F. Scott Fitzgerald had died eating a Hershey bar, and it just kind of laid there. It sounded like one of these urban myths, but I looked and looked for months to try to find out if this was true or not. And the only thing that I eventually found out was a book written by one of his mistresses that said he did die eating a chocolate bar, but it was that he had a heart attack while he was eating it. And I was wondering if you came across that in your research. I thought that was a fun story.
No, you know, that particular one never came my way. But, you know, there is this secret world of English majors, and they know things that none of us know outside that world.
Well, I thought it would be a terrible, certainly a public relations blot if it was announced he died eating a Hershey bar, but I guess we can put that to rest.
Well, you know, and it does melt in your mouth eventually, so I think it's hard to choke on one unless it had almonds. You know, maybe that was it. That was an issue.
Michael, Ray, thank you very much for your phone call. Michael, I'm wondering if during the early part of the Hershey chocolate bar years, Milton Hershey understood that there would be a mystique about chocolate.
You know, I think he did. I think that all the chocolate manufacturers intuited this addictive quality. And in Cadbury, in the case of Cadbury in Great Britain and Roundtree, those bars were made by families that had Quaker roots. And they saw this as almost a social mission to provide a nutritious alternative. Actually, it was considered an alternative to alcohol. And Milton's early advertising included the wonderful slogan, "More nutritious than meat." and he did market the purity of the ingredients that went into the chocolate bar. Lancaster County, even today, is renowned as a wonderful source of great agricultural products raised by Amish and Mennonite farmers. And I think he did know that if he could be first into the market with an affordable chocolate bar, it would take off.
And what was his first product was the Hershey bar. What was his next? What was his next product?
Well, I know they went to the Kiss pretty soon afterwards.
And whose idea was the Kiss?
I think it was his. But again, this was something that could have been borrowed. The Kiss shape had been used for candy drops going back many years, and there were Kisses being made in Europe. The Italian Bacci is one example. So he was very willing to borrow, and this was just another way to shape the chocolate.
Tell us about the Hershey Industrial School. How did it get started, and what's it tell you about Milton Hershey's character and longings, his founding of the school, that is?
Well, you know, this fellow had a three-part legacy. He had this magnificent company, which today dominates the candy market in America. He has this dream of this ideal hometown, which I think was to create the hometown he never had, and also to demonstrate to other Americans that it was possible to have a perfect place. And the third thing that he left behind was what was begun as the Milton S. Hershey Industrial School. The idea that he had was to create a school that would provide all that what were then called orphan boys might need to prepare them for life. And parents would literally sign over guardianship to the school, and the children as young as four would be enrolled and educated and nurtured until they graduated high school and then went off in the world. And the industrial part was that they were to learn a skill that would make them self-sufficient. But the real genesis of this was in his own life, in Milton's life. He married a woman named Catherine, nicknamed Kitty, in the 1890s. And by the early 1900s, they were quite convinced that they'd never have children and contemplated their fortune being left behind to no heirs. And they had this notion that, well, we'll just create heirs, and the heirs will be the orphan children of America. Secretly, and it's hard to imagine someone doing such a grand positive thing secretly today, but secretly they created a trust and rewrote their wills and gave every bit of their money to this school. And you have to understand that at the time, there was not just the Hershey Chocolate Company, but there was Hershey Entertainment Companies, a Hershey Furniture Factory, a bank, a trolley system. This was a massive number of companies and a huge amount of money. And
you have to understand in today's dollars that the endowment remains huge. We're not talking about a gift of a few hundred thousand dollars in 1900 money. We're talking about something that's worth billions and billions and billions today.
$8.5 billion with a B dollars, and it's all for a school for 1,200 kids. Every time you buy a Hershey bar or take a ride on a roller coaster at Hershey Park, whatever pennies of profit are generated go to this school. And, you know, it's a magnificent thing to think about someone being that selfless, but that's really almost the tip of the iceberg. You know, this man was so devoted to his vision that when he decided to start his own sugar plantation in Cuba and bought up tens of thousands of acres, he built another community of Hershey there and provided for the education of children, built housing. And the wonderful thing about his Cuban adventure, and this is something that I think people in Hershey were surprised by, is that he was a completely different person when he went abroad. His winter months in Havana were full of time at the casinos and watching very risque entertainment, and he built a golf course for himself. Henry Ford would come to visit, and two of them would motor around the countryside. And when he traveled in Europe, he was known as Mr. Maximum, because at the casinos, he always laid down the maximum bet. So he was one fellow in Hershey and a quite different and really fun guy to be around whenever he traveled.
Well, what happens in Cuba and Europe stays in Cuba and Europe. Or did the people in Hershey, Pennsylvania, know about their benefactor's behavior abroad?
A little bit of it leaked out, and I think mostly because he was so playful when he was abroad. There's a wonderful story of him intentionally embarrassing the wife of an executive who came to visit in Cuba by making sure she saw the semi-nude shows in the casinos. And I just think that he let his hair down, as they say, when he was traveling. And I know his wife, who was a far more sophisticated and worldly woman than others in Hershey might have been, adored this time abroad. And I think she lived for the days when they boarded a ship and he would sleep off his fatigue on the way across the Atlantic and then just take her around Europe and show her a great time.
Let's take a few more phone calls. Neil is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Neil.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. It's a fascinating show. I have to admit I didn't know that much about Milton Hershey, but you mentioned Henry Ford, and that was the other name that immediately came to mind. They obviously knew each other and were friends. How much, in your research, how much of a parallel or how much common ground philosophically do you find between Henry Ford and Milton Hershey?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, Ford became known for profit sharing and paying workers enough so that they could buy the product that they were making. But Milton Hershey actually did it first. He was giving 5 to 20% bonuses to line workers as early as 1910 to 1915. So he was, and I do think that he was far more progressive in his attitude toward the level of pay workers deserved and the level of respect they deserved. Early on, his philosophy included criticism of both the excesses of capital, which was unique in his time, and also the excesses of labor. He tried to play it right down the middle. This didn't always work, and eventually in the 30s, there was a very bitter strike, the late 1930s. And it's all the more ironic because Milton had actually conducted his own version of the WPA program before FDR started it. When the Great Depression hit, he began building things all over Hershey. Big, massive buildings, a hotel. He built a thing called the Windowless Office Building that was a technological marvel of the day. He didn't need these things, but the workers needed work. So those who were not able to work at the factory because demand for the product fell off still could make a living in construction. Thereby, the town barely experienced the Depression.
You mentioned FDR. I'm wondering how influenced politically and philosophically Milton was by Teddy Roosevelt's progressives.
He sure was a kindred soul. He very much, he was very suspicious of monopolies and of great, enormous corporate organizations. He had had a bad experience with the Sugar Trust. And that's why he went to Cuba and had his own sugar mills and sugar plantations and transportation system. So he was a Roosevelt kind of man. What's fascinating is he considered himself politically conservative. He was a Republican. But in today's world, he'd be considered practically socialist. He was so radical. He was against inherited wealth. He really believed that there should be a very low threshold for the amount of money a man should accumulate, and the rest should go to public good. And he lived this out so directly that by the time he reached his last years, he gave away his own home. The one mansion in the town of Hershey belonged to Milton. He lived in two rooms. He spent much of his time sitting at a card table, reading the paper and smoking his cigars, and the rest of the house was the country club's clubhouse. It wasn't the ordinary kind of country club. This was a very low dues facility, and everyone belonged.
Merrill is calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Hi, Merrill.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you emphasized how much of a role Hershey played during World War II. A lot of us who were in World War II, going overseas to fight in Germany and so forth, went through Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania at Harrisburg. And we used to spend a lot of our weekend leave time when we had it and went over to Hershey to visit the town and the park. They had an excellent hockey team in those days, which was, I don't know if it still exists, but they were very hospitable. They threw the town open to the young GIs. I was 18 at the time, and had dances at the USO and so forth.
Well, you know, the Hershey Bears, that was the name of the team, is still an active franchise. They pack this arena there. You know, when you mentioned World War II, I immediately thought of it was called the Ration D and then the Ration E, and these were these very big Hershey bars made to survive in rough conditions. And the Hershey Company won several awards from the Department of Defense, or I guess it would be the War Department then, for their stepped-up production of the Hershey bars and for the quality of the product that went abroad. And your description of how hospitable the town was is right on. Milton himself, when there would be drives for the USO or the Red Cross, would do things like give his personal car to be raffled off. I mean, they were very much engaged in doing anything they could to support others. And it's really, I know it's hard to believe that there would be a guy this good. And he wasn't all good. You know, he was someone who could fire someone for pinching a fellow worker. But in the main, if there was an opportunity to contribute, they did.
Merrill, thank you very much. Let's take another. David is calling now from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, David.
Hi. My question is whether you've already mentioned Hershey's relationship with Henry Ford, and I was curious about whether or not he had an influence on other utopian industrial enterprises such as the Kellogg Company, and also another one which is not that well known is the Miller Electric Company, which makes arc welding equipment.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that he was the model for others. I think that he, in a way, was inspired by the early utopian experiments, and all these things kind of happened concurrently, that people were trying different ways of creating utopia. And there was also something called the City Beautiful movement that had started in the 19th century and progressed through the early 20th century, where the idea of great civic life and architecture that was uplifting and city planning and gardens, this was all in the air. So he may have had some influence by example, but there was this feeding off of each other that took place. And so I wouldn't give him too much credit for inspiring any other successes that might have come along.
Let's try and squeeze in one more call if we can. Pat is dialing from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Pat. You're on Point.
Hi. I grew up near Hershey, not too far from Hershey, and we used to go to Hershey Park and especially to the zoo, which was full of nothing but American animals right by the park. And I'm wondering, my question is it the only place in the world where you can look at a buffalo and smell chocolate at the same time?
It may well be. And, you know, the zoo was a wonderful part of the town. And it actually, the zoo and the park itself were free to town residents all during Milton's life and well afterwards, as were many of the other facilities. It really, for children, it must have been a wonderful thing.
Well, Pat, it's a wonderful town.
Pat, thank you so much for calling, and thanks for that funny question. Michael D'Antonio, let me ask you, how is Milton Hershey viewed in Hershey, PA, today?
You know, it's the one place I've ever been where 50 or 60 years after the death of a leader, people still ask, what would Milton do? When they have a problem, they literally consider his legacy and consider his philosophy.
And that came up recently in the controversy over the Hershey Industrial School.
Right. There was a proposal to divest the trust of its stock in the Hershey Company. And from a financial point of view, it may have made a lot of sense because it was really, it's the dominant holding in this $8.5 billion trust, and people think that's too risky. But when it was proposed, all parties in the town seemed to rise up against it. And they did. There were signs that said, wait till Mr. Hershey finds out. And, you know, no one calls him Milton in town. Everyone calls him Mr. Hershey. And when I'm there, I find myself doing the same thing.
Let's take one more call about the legacy of the Hershey Chocolate Bar. Trudy is dialing from Bolton. Hi, Trudy.
Hi. Yeah, I've just been listening to this, and I was I just want you to know that when I was a child growing up in Germany, I was 5 years old at the end of the war. I mean, I live here now, of course. But when the Americans came in and liberated Germany, and I lived in this little village where we were evacuated from the city, and the tanks came up, you know, like this mountain, and the first thing I saw was a GI opening the hatch of the tank and throwing out candy bars. And, of course, I'm positive it must have been Hershey. I didn't know at the time. And, of course, that always impressed me, and I always felt from the very beginning about the generosity of the American people.
Well, Trudy, thank you very much. Milton Hershey getting credit, perhaps where credit is due.
Oh, I think so. You know, the one thing that was different, though, about Hershey when they went abroad, unlike Coca-Cola, local people really fastened onto the taste of Coke, and they accepted it, and Coke was able to become a multinational company. If you hadn't had chocolate in years and you were a German kid, you appreciated the Hershey bar, but once the war was over, people didn't want them, so they never did grow beyond the American border.
Give us one word that would sum up Milton Hershey's legacy from your point of view.
Idealism. This is a man who was idealistic, and he lived by his idealism.
Michael D'Antonio, author of the new book, Hershey, Milton S. Hershey's Extraordinary Life of Wealth, Empire, and Utopian Dreams. The only book in the bookstore right now that looks edible when you see it because the cover is a picture of the Hershey's chocolate bar. Michael D'Antonio, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook.